Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the U.S. doesn't seem as friendly to international visitors these days. That includes those artists who come to the country to start their careers and be part of the cultural exchange. We'll hear more about it. Higher education is requesting more money in the next state budget, but that's not an easy sell. We'll have a report. Also, a new documentary criticizes the presence of Chinese international students at the U of I. We'll hear from a woman who's making it her mission to get black women tested for cancer. Black women are 40% more likely to die from cancer than women who are white. And the news may make you feel overwhelmed these days. What are some solutions to staying informed and maintaining your mental health? Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. International artists and musicians have long seen the U.S. and the Midwest as a place to share their work and build careers. But for many foreign creatives, just getting here has become harder, more expensive, and fraught with fear. Josie Fischels reports for the Midwest Newsroom.
You're listening to Swedish folk a cappella group Kungro. The group of four women embarked on their second U.S. tour last year, starting in Illinois. But for the first week of that month-long tour, member Emma Bjorling's voice was missing.
I was stuck back home without a visa.
To meet their scheduled tour dates, the group first paid nearly $3,000 in expedited processing fees for foreign artist visas. But because Bjorling was on a tour with a different music group in Canada at the time, she ran into additional delays caused by recent changes to U.S. non-immigrant visas. She was required to return home to Sweden to complete an in-person interview, which she says she hadn't been asked to do before. She ended up missing her international flight with the group while waiting for her visa. In the end, Kungro lost money on its U.S. tour and will not tour the country at all in 2026.
With all the additional fees and costs and troubles and stress, it's flipping it all over, right? So it's not worth it, not financially and not stress-wise and workload-wise.
Visa processing fees and delays have grown significantly over the past year, discouraging international artists who want to perform in the U.S. And that's just part of the picture.
There have been a number of artists that have canceled, decided not to tour.
Mateo Mukahi is with the International Latino Cultural Center of Chicago, a nonprofit that invites international dancers, filmmakers, and musicians to share their work at different venues around the city. He says some artists are choosing to avoid the U.S. altogether, not just because of the paperwork, but because of fear over what might happen when they arrive.
If you're going to tour in another country and you get hassled to no end upon entry, doesn't make you feel very welcome.
Immigration restrictions have intensified under the Trump administration, leading to heightened scrutiny of visiting artists at ports of entry. Last summer, a Colombian artist scheduled to paint a mural in Iowa was sent back home after being denied entry. The mural she'd created had to go up without her. A Czech clarinetist was forced to cancel a series of Midwest performances after being detained 4 hours because of a documentation issue. He was put on a flight back to Prague. Mukahi says artists still see the U.S. as a prestigious place to share their work. But now they're thinking twice.
I spoke personally to some artists who were like, I don't know if I want to deal with that. You know, I don't know if I want to come in, even if I got everything in order, if I'm going to get hassled for 2 hours at the border.
While it's hard to quantify just how many foreign artists are skipping the Midwest, Jennifer Rowe with Folk Alliance International in Kansas City says other major markets, like Europe, feel more accessible right now.
You know, I understand the rationale for that, but that's unfortunate for our communities here in the U.S. that are missing out on the opportunities for that cultural exchange.
Rowe's organization works to ensure artists are aware of resources that can help them travel to the U.S. to showcase their talents.
Providing people as they cross the border with the best information, the best way to respond to questions is the education that we like to provide to people.
She says cultural exchange is incredibly valuable, especially in the Midwest, which is home to many independent venues and rural communities that often support performances with grants.
There's so much to learn from bringing in people from different communities and cultures.
But until the process feels more predictable, arts organizations can expect artists to rethink their visits in the coming year. For the Midwest Newsroom, I'm Josie Fischels.
Many major medical and healthcare organizations have decided to ignore new guidance from the federal government on childhood immunization. President Donald Trump and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have reduced the number of vaccine recommendations. Last September, Republican Congressman Darren LaHood of Peoria voiced concerns about some of the statements coming out of the agency. But LaHood is refusing to break entirely with the Trump administration on the vaccine question. That is, even though in this interview with Charlie Schlinker, LaHood acknowledged he now has more than concerns.
I do.
What should happen?
Individuals, my constituents, what I would tell them is rely on their own doctor, their own medical advice that they get. They ought to be able to have the right to do that. But, I would rely on your own physician and where you get your information for healthcare for you and your family.
Shouldn't physicians and the government be largely in agreement on this question?
Well, I think there can be distinctions. I think, and clearly this administration has had a number of those with the new HHS secretary and some of the advocacy that he's been doing. But again, I go back to, I think most of these decisions are personal decisions that ought to be made by your doctor.
And do you think the government should reverse itself on that new vaccine schedule?
I think many of these decisions are personal decisions.
You've recently announced a couple of significant grants, $1.5 million for an air cargo road at the Central Illinois Regional Airport and more than $500,000 for the city of Bloomington to update its real-time information and crime center technology. What makes those projects stand out compared to the other hundreds and hundreds of requests for help that you get?
Our airport in Bloomington Normal is a vital transportation asset, and particularly as it relates to air cargo. Air cargo continues to be an economic driver in McLean County and the use of the airport for air cargo. So it's the design and construction of the air cargo road, but it also pertains to traffic safety. So the road that will be constructed, Charlie, will allow for a separate road for cargo and traffic and trucks to get to the airport, to that to the private aspect of the airport. And again, allow citizens and individual travelers that are using the commercial or the regular airlines to have to not be interacting with those trucks. The other project that you mentioned, a little under $600,000 that will go to the city of Bloomington, that's going to help with their police department and their communications. We have to continue to upgrade our communications when it comes to real-time information at our crime center there. So I work closely with, obviously, Mayor Brady and the team there. And really, this will allow them to acquire essential technology and software for real-time information and crime center there. And it'll be state-of-the-art in terms of what they'll have there. It will include technology that pertains to crime mapping, predictive analytics, and expanding public safety camera infrastructure.
We're talking with Congressman Darren LaHood. What are your legislative priorities this year?
One is I've been an advocate against reduction of our tariffs. I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court case that's going to come down on ruling on IEPA will give us an opportunity to pivot. We in Congress have to be a co-equal branch of government when it comes to tariffs. What I've said publicly, Charlie, is tariffs are taxes. They're taxes on my farmers, my manufacturers, my producers. I think we need to have a reduction in terms of the tariffs, particularly how they affect our allies. And I think it's been a hindrance on the economy in many ways. Many of the farmers that I represent in agriculture community are suffering because of the tariffs. Secondly, the other priority has to be affordability when it comes to healthcare. We haven't done enough on healthcare, on bringing down the cost of healthcare. And so that has to be a priority also.
Tariffs are only one aspect of the farmer profitability problem. Another one raised by the new Illinois Farm Bureau president is the concentration of ownership of seed companies and fertilizer companies that amount to, he implied, a monopoly. Does that need to be considered heavily by Congress?
I'm not sure that that's the biggest priority. I would put the farm bill number one. I would put tariffs number two. I think the other one would be E15 year-round, which I'm a strong advocate for, in working on the RFS, the renewable fuel standards that helps our corn farmers. In terms of the monopoly, I mean, that hasn't been raised when I talk to my farmers and folks in the agriculture community. I'd like to hear more evidence and focus on that.
The tariffs, if the last term is any guide, will result in a protracted loss of market share for U.S. farmers. And the amount of support payments that the administration has proposed are not going to make those whole at all, as they did not the last time either. What needs to happen to help farmers in the interim until 5-10 years out they can rebuild their markets?
I would tend to agree with you. I don't think these bridge payments of roughly $12 billion, while I'm glad the administration is doing that to help our farmers, I think you have to have market access. I think you have to work with our like-minded allies to reduce some of these tariff burdens, particularly when you look at countries that we have strong alliances with, Japan, South Korea, you know, our European allies, the European Union. I think we have to work on India, which there's a trade agreement. I think it's a combination of free trade agreements that allow agriculture, those markets and access. That's number one. Number two, I think a reduction in tariffs. When you get into a trade war over tariffs, the first pawn in the trade war is always agriculture, and they suffer because of that. And so, again, I think it's a combination of both those things. And, you know, I hear my farmers say it all the time. They want trade, not aid. And I think we got to predicate a policy that, you know, moves us in that direction.
Darren LaHood is a Republican congressman from Peoria. He spoke with Charlie Schlinker. The Illinois Department of Public Health said it will adopt the 2026 child and adolescent immunization schedule recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. The department says there was no scientific data to warrant a change. A former campaign advisor to Donald Trump has put out a documentary film that criticizes the presence of Chinese international students at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. Emily Hayes has more.
Yes, that's Illini football broadcast in Mandarin Chinese in the middle of America. Why?
Steve Cortez was an advisor for President Trump's 2016 and 2020 campaigns. He's from the Chicago suburbs and has friends who went to the University of Illinois, some of whose kids he says are qualified and haven't gotten in. He thinks that's because Chinese international students took their place.
My main hope is that we stop allowing Chinese nationals to attend university in the United States. I think it's wrong. I think that number shouldn't be 300,000. It should be zero.
Sharon Nguyen is a sophomore at U of I and is Vietnamese American. She says it's sad to hear people say immigrants are taking opportunities away when they enrich their communities. For example, Nguyen says U of I's global population gives her the chance to research differences between international speakers of Vietnamese and those born in the U.S.
Because I actually had a friend that what came from Vietnam down to here, and those types of research will be eliminated or just like endangered, I guess, if there's not a lot of international students coming down here to do those types of things.
U of I spokesperson Pat Wade says the university enrolls more in-state students than most Big Ten schools. This past fall's freshman class had 700 students from China and almost 7,000 from the state of Illinois. I'm Emily Hayes.
Central Illinois lawmakers say they have concerns with increasing higher education funding because of a tight state budget. We have more on that from Eric Stock.
The Illinois Board of Higher Education is requesting a nearly 5% increase in its budget for public colleges and universities, and it wants the state to change to a flexible funding system informed by specific institutional factors referred to as evidence-based. The state adopted an evidence-based model for K-12 education funding nearly a decade ago as a way to reduce disparities. Illinois lawmakers are waiting for the proposed budget and more data to make a final decision on higher ed funding. State Representative Sharon Chung, a Democrat from Bloomington, is not optimistic there will be an increase in higher ed funding this year.
I'm not quite sure what that's going to look like. It's going to be, I have to say, it's going to be really tricky. We have so many needs throughout the state, especially with a lot of the federal funding cuts.
Chung says she supports evidence-based funding for higher education, but it would require more funding to work.
We want to make sure that universities are also being funded in an equitable, predictable way. But the big roadblock is trying to figure out how we're going to fund this.
Chung says another reason her new funding formula has not passed is because of opposition from the University of Illinois. The U of I system has argued the legislation penalizes universities that are closer to reaching their adequacy targets. Chung says Illinois State University is discussing how to save money and finding areas to cut if there is no funding increase. Glenn Nelson, ISU's Vice President for Finance and Planning, says the university is looking into different budget scenarios for the coming fiscal year Nelson says they're continuing to find options to minimize the financial impacts on students. In a statement, Nelson says ISU supports any funding increase and would welcome a funding model that addresses the inequality in higher education funding. State Representative Sharon Chung says the most immediate way to support universities now is for Governor J.B. Pritzker to release $30 million of the higher ed budget that he has the authority to direct. The governor has withheld the money, saying there's too much uncertainty in Washington to spend that money now. Ashley Farmer, president of United Faculty at ISU, says despite rising enrollment, universities are now focused on covering costs instead of providing a quality education because of decades of underfunding by the state. Farmer says that's led to tuition increases, class size increases, and service cuts across the state.
And workers who dedicate their lives to serving students are told to fight for scraps.
At an education union rally in Normal, Farmer proposed a way for lawmakers to get more money for higher ed.
Illinois can fix this if they choose to. The ultra wealthy in this state do not pay their fair share. It's time for that to change.
Illinois House Speaker Chris Welch has proposed a new tax on millionaires as the state faces a budget deficit of $2.2 billion. Any tax increase could be a tough sell in Springfield. Democratic lawmakers have expressed interest in passing a millionaire's tax, but worry it could force the wealthy to leave the state. And it's a non-starter for Republicans. State Senator Chris Baucom, whose district includes part of McLean County, doesn't think higher ed needs any more funding.
I'm very convinced that the current buckets of money that are flowing into those areas would do more than enough to support the quality of education that we need to deliver.
Republican State Senator Sally Turner of Logan County says Illinois should make its universities more affordable. And Turner says evidence-based funding is one way to make that happen.
I guess it's a fair and equitable way that we can support our students and send them to the universities here in Illinois and keep them here that they can afford and that we can assist in that endeavor.
Turner says her concern is the new funding model would cost money the state doesn't have. With reporting from WGLT State Capitol correspondent Evan Holden, I'm Eric Stock.
The governor delivers his annual budget address this coming week. We'll return with more of Statewide in a moment. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A book by an Iowa-based folklorist and photographer chronicles life on the Mississippi River during the 20th century. The stories are told through the words of a Western Illinois man whose life revolved around the river. Rich Egger reports.
The book Back Them Days, Reflections on a Life on the Mississippi River, is self-published by Sherry Pardee. It tells the story of the late Clinton Bust Downs, a commercial fisherman who lived in the tiny river town of Meyer on the westernmost tip of Illinois.
Bust was one of those special people that you meet in life that you realize this is an exemplary human being and someone who has just lived honorably, lived well, and just has done amazing things with their life in a way beyond what normal people do.
Buss was a third-generation fisherman born in 1915. As a boy, he was nicknamed Buster, which was shortened to Buss, and that's the name everyone knew him by. Pardee says she's spoken with fishermen way up north on the Mississippi who know of Buss, respected him, and consider him a legend.
He was almost like a Daniel Boone figure. He would trap and hunt with his father. When they weren't fishing, he and his father would trap and hunt from Canada all the way down to Mississippi, way beyond what the normal fisherman or hunter would do.
Pardee met Buss in the summer of 1987 when the Illinois Arts Council hired her to survey traditions of commercial fishermen on the upper Mississippi. She lived in Quincy and had heard stories about Buss, so she drove up to Meyer to meet him. She ended up listening to him tell stories for 3 hours.
Buss lived on the Mississippi. The chair in his house he always sat in looked right out on the Mississippi, and it was a place that he lived and it was a place that he worked.
For the next 4 years, Pardee kept returning and recording his stories. And Back Them Days is largely told in Buss's own words.
Buss had a great sense of humor, was very philosophical, tells great stories of big hauls of fish, game wardens, floods, people that were traveling up and down the river, stories of giant catfish.
Pardee says Buss had a beautiful rhythm and prose to his speech that she found poetic. She says she simply organized the stories so that there was a flow that worked for the book, and her black and white photographs add a timeless element to the pages. Pardee learned from Buss that there was a community of 38 fishermen around Meyer when he was a young man in the 1930s. He was the youngest of the group. Most of the others were his father's peers.
Back in the 30s and before the locks and dams were put in the Mississippi, fishermen were catching fish by the tons, and they were paid by the tons.
Pardee says Buss worked no matter the weather and no matter the conditions on the river. There were times he fell overboard and almost died, but others would rescue him, drag him ashore, and he'd end up going back to work, never complaining.
It was just what he did, and it was just his work and his life.
Pardee says a lot of Buss's memories were of how the river once was as opposed to contemporary times. He often spoke about back them days and nowadays.
When he was younger, the Mississippi River was about 100 feet deep, and often now it's about 6 feet deep.
Buss witnessed the pollution caused by chemical runoff from farms and how the fish population decreased. But Buss saw the river in very practical terms. He did not romanticize it.
He could also see how the changes in the world were affecting that and his livelihood. So he saw it as a time that was passing.
Buss moved to Quincy after the flood of 1993 devastated Meyer. His last years were spent in the Quincy Veterans Home. Buss passed away in 2008. Pardee hopes readers will develop a deep respect for what she calls the exemplary life Buss Downs lived, and she hopes they're moved by his wisdom. Rich Egger reporting.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture climate hubs across the country aim to better understand how climate change affects agriculture and forestry and help people adapt. But the future of the hubs is uncertain. And as Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, that's as farmers across the country continue to experience more extreme and unpredictable weather.
It's 10 degrees at Heritage Hill Farm in central Iowa. Except for some garlic sprouts poking out of the ground, everything is brown and yellow this winter morning.
I'm so ready for the day where, like, things are greening up and we're actually, you know, able to start working in the soil again.
That's Jessica Krupika. She runs this diversified vegetable farm with her husband, their two boys, and some hired help. Even as they look forward to spring, Krupika says that season brings new challenges with heavier downpours and big temperature swings.
So that really impacts certain crops, especially like the lettuce, where the temperatures, if they get just too warm, they just get bitter. So you have a unmarketable crop.
Krupika says they're scaling back certain crops, shifting planting dates, and adding more greenhouses to stay profitable.
With the climate change, we need to be more nimble.
Over three quarters of Iowa farmers surveyed by Iowa State University say climate change is happening. And the USDA created regional climate hubs over a decade ago, in large part to help producers adapt. Julian Reyes was the national coordinator for the 11 hubs for several years.
There was a lot of great climate data, for example, that existed at NOAA and at NASA, but there needed to be an in-between, right, to translate what that meant for farmers, ranchers, and foresters. And that's where I think the climate hubs excelled the best.
Last year, the Trump administration proposed cutting funding for the hubs in its 2026 budget request. Congress slashed the funding, according to committee notes in November, but just how much the hubs will lose is unclear. A USDA spokesperson said budget allocations are still being formulated. Reyes says the hub's annual funding was roughly $30 million before he left in 2024.
They definitely punched above their weight. For the amount of funding that they received, they delivered benefits to not only the USDA, but farmers, ranchers, and foresters. I was going to say threefold. I would say even fourfold.
Illinois state climatologist Trent Ford says the climate hub in Ames, Iowa, makes it easier to share information and resources with researchers and crop advisors across eight states.
We know that weather and climate and the impacts that they cause don't stop at state borders.
He says the hubs have also played an important role in supporting local research. For example, he says he struggled to get funding from national scientific groups to study how warming winters impact apple production in his state.
They'll come back and say, well, Illinois is not really a major apple producer compared to like Washington or Michigan, right? But what am I supposed to say then to the apple producers in Illinois who are trying to make a living growing apples?
Ford says the Midwest Climate Hub helped him find funding to start the research, which led to a larger report about climate change impacts on fruit trees and vineyards in the region. Lori Nowatsky is the former associate director of the Midwest Climate Hub. She says the expected funding cuts come on top of massive federal layoffs last year.
I think the more prominent impact to the climate hubs has been the effect on the ability to keep staff and hire new staff.
Nowatsky was one of tens of thousands of federal employees who were fired last February. She was rehired with temporary job security and ultimately took a deferred resignation offer. Nowatsky found a research job outside the USDA, but she worries about early career scientists and widespread federal cuts to other weather and climate research programs.
To me, the greatest concern there is that we are going to have less robust weather-related services for farmers moving forward. I think that's almost a given, considering the changes that have happened this year.
Nowatsky says farmers will continue to experience more extreme and unpredictable weather, but they may have fewer resources to plan for the future. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
The American Cancer Society is marking Black History Month by highlighting disparities in cancer diagnosis and deaths. African Americans have the highest death rate of any ethnic group for most cancers, and one-third of African American women report experiencing racial discrimination when visiting a healthcare provider. The Cancer Society has launched a study to improve that. Erica Austin from Springfield is an ambassador for Voices of Black Women. She was diagnosed in 2023 and has a genetic defect making her at higher risk of certain cancers. She's gotten regularly tested and is encouraging other women to take part in the study. She told Colleen Holden she's worried too many women don't get tested due to lack of access to care or a mistrust of the health system.
For me, it's using my voice to help influence others to get checked out. Yeah, you may not feel it, but something could be there.
I know in the press release, I saw a lot of stuff about health equity, and it kind of seems that that's like a big focal point.
When health equity is absent, we do see higher rates of preventable illnesses. We see later diagnosis, and we see poorer outcomes. And we also see a higher mortality. And since we're talking about Black women, it's particularly amongst the marginalized communities that we see these health equity issues as a consequence. And also, the consequences of not having health equity, it also leads to mistrust in health systems, lower engagement in prevention and research, and greater long-term costs to families and communities. Ultimately, if we have the lack of health equity, it affects not just individuals, but the overall health of society.
You talked a little bit about some systemic barriers there. Like, what do those look like, whether it be kind of like access to care or also like quality of care?
I think it comes to access to care, limited access to specialists. You know, when you're diagnosed, you want to have somebody who knows what they're doing. And so sometimes people may not know how to do the research. They may not know the specialist to contact. It may not even have insurance, right? And insurance is a big one, especially now in our economy and what's going on. Insurance is a big one. So, all of that plays a part in why cancer doesn't affect everyone equally because of the different things that they are experiencing, the access to care, the lack of knowledge, the social stressors, things of that nature.
How can people who are like more on the outside, maybe people who aren't quite as affected by this issue, how can they advocate for the people who are affected by this without kind of minimizing the voices of the people who have experienced it?
Decision making, policies, right? So if you have policies that come out, I know that there are a host of petitions that get sent out. Sign a petition for us. Help us out. Let us get things passed in legislation that can help further using our voices so that we can get different resources to help us, right? They can help us get our stories out. But like I said before, definitely policy making is a big one. I feel like policies go a long way. And so if they can help us in that area, that can go a long way.
That's Erica Austin from Springfield, an ambassador for Voices of Black Women. The American Cancer Society reports Black women are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer than white women, and they're twice as likely to die when diagnosed before age 50. The jazz great Herbie Hancock is United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organizations, or UNESCO, Jazz Ambassador. Last month, Hancock announced the lineup for the 15th annual International Jazz Day. Northern Illinois University Associate Professor Bobby Broom is on the list. Yvonne Booz talked with Broom to find out what it means to him.
What was the feeling when you found out that you would be taking part in the International Jazz Day festivities coming up in April?
Well, I had received an email about 6 weeks or so prior to the announcement. So I was aware of it, but the email was written on behalf of the two main ambassadors for jazz for UNESCO, who are Herbie and Kurt Elling, the vocalist from Chicago. So how I felt was a number of things. I was validated in a way, which is an ongoing thing. I mean, no matter how many accomplishments I achieve or how much praise or whatever I receive, it's never enough. No, no, there's always the counter feeling. I don't know if it's part of being me or being an artist or what it is, but there's a balance between or a symbiosis between confidence and lack thereof. You know, you have to be extremely confident to pursue a life in the arts, I believe. It's just very difficult. So you have to withstand that, and you have to have some kind of fortitude personally to withstand that. And hopefully that fuels your artistic drive and your vision and everything that you do. So I'm speaking of myself when I say you, because that's what's happened. Something makes me do this despite any seeming difficulty, real or imagined. So that's the confident part. The other, then the rest is the counter to that. Like, we don't know, am I good enough? Are these things not happening because of that? Are people going to like this next thing I'm doing or the things that I've done? So yeah, I was excited. I felt like, wow, it was kind of unbelievable, surreal in a way. Herbie Hancock was the reason why I got into jazz. Honestly, I wasn't into jazz. And then I heard Herbie Hancock's hit on the radio, Chameleon. This was 75 or 6. And I went, oh, they're saying that's jazz? Oh, that's jazz? Oh, if that's jazz, then maybe I do like jazz. So I pursued it because of that. And there was another record, Grover Washington Jr. record. If not for those things, I don't know.
Wow. You got the email. Was that the first time this opportunity even crossed your mind?
Yes. Over the last few years, I recall watching the global concert and, you know, people that I knew would be playing and, there's Sadao Watanabe, oh, there's Marcus Miller, oh, you know, and, but nope, never in my wildest dreams, because I don't see myself on that level. But that's going to sound weird. I don't mean it like that. I don't mean musically. I mean in terms of stature in the industry. So there's like the machinations that happen, and you know, certain people always get picked to do certain things, and I don't see myself as one of those people until now. So it's really a beautiful thing. It really, really is. And it's kind of like recognition, like, yeah, dude, you
You're one of us.
The 15th annual International Jazz Day All-Star Global Concert will take place April 30th at venues throughout Chicago. We'll talk news overload. It's coming up next on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, the news can make you feel overloaded, but you still want to stay up to date. Recently, Sasha Ann Simons talked with some experts about possible solutions, and today we revisit that conversation.
The news, let's be honest, it can be a lot. How many notifications on your phone do you get about the news in just one day? Ah, my anxiety is already spiking just hearing those dings. Now, we know it's important to be a well-informed citizen, and of course, we are more connected to the world's news than ever. But how do you stay checked in and avoid headline stress disorder that comes with all that doom scrolling? Joining us now with more is Alexa James, who's CEO of NAMI Chicago. And we've got Stuart Shankman, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern Medicine. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for being.
Thanks for joining us. So how did you, were you getting goosebumps hearing those dings as well, the notifications?
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For sure.
There's so much news all at once, I feel. Whether you're like super well connected to the news or not, it just comes at you from all directions. Is it something that you deal with personally, Stuart?
Absolutely, yeah. We all get those dings, and it's unprecedented in terms of human history, right? Like we, mm-hmm. the access to news that we have, you know, it used to be just the 6 o'clock news, and now it's
remember
it's 24/7. Yeah.
6 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Alexa, you're nodding.
Totally. I mean, it's why listening to your show is always so lovely because you do such a nice balance. But we're also, and we are drawn to the sad, the negative, the tragic. And then we start to mirror some of those feelings. So yeah, I personally do. I was just saying in the green room that I got the headline, for example, about the budget or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I need a break. I can't really dive into it anymore because it's already, it really already heightens your anxiety.
So what do? You literally shut it down? Read the headline and you just close your phone and walk away?
Shut it down, because I think that, you know, our anxiety can be utilized to say, what more information do we need to feel safe? I don't need any more information right now to feel safe. Mm-hmm. I know what I need to know for now, and I know what the next steps are.
Well, Stuart, Alexa said something pretty key. She said people are drawn to this, right? Why are we so drawn to seeking out information even when it stresses us out?
I think it's reducing the uncertainty. So right now, that the times that we're living in are incredibly uncertain, right? We don't know what the future is going to hold for our budget, for our city, for our families, our kids, and so when we seek information, that's an attempt to sort of reduce uncertainty. Which we in our lab, for example, has done a lot of work on people who are very sensitive to uncertainty. Mm. And that's a big mechanism of anxiety and anxiety related problems.
And what do you mean by being sensitive to uncertainty?
So, hypothetically, is it possible that a meteor is going to hit our building in the next 30 seconds? Sure. The probability of that is pretty low because, you know, NASA probably would have identified it and Bruce Willis would have been flying up there. And but we sort of live without uncertainty, right? You know, more realistically, we walk down the street, right? And we know there's risks of us, you know, God forbid, getting hit by a car or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there's some people who are so sensitive to that uncertainty that they need to gather information and try to reduce the possibility of these bad things happening. And I think, you know, doom scrolling and reading about the news is an attempt to reduce that uncertainty.
Yeah. So
reduce that unknown.
Mm-hmm. Doom scrolling, if you look in the dictionary, it's defined as, you know, spending excessive time online scrolling through news or other content that makes you feel sad, anxious, angry, etc. How do you define it, Alexa? What's doom scrolling to you? What does that look like?
I think about it similarly to other types of addictions that we have. And biologically, I think that's a lot of what's going on, because even though it makes us feel sad, we think that that means that there's not some type of return. There's not some type of reward system that's going off in our brain like a slot machine. And a lot of these algorithms and systems are actually built on that same precedent of giving us that hit, giving us more information, feeling like we're in the know, feeling like we have power. Mm. So, yes, I think it's dangerous, and I think it's super important to utilize our insight to say, okay, what am I going to do to shift this a little bit? Is this really serving me anymore?
So those friends of mine that I'm thinking of right now,
who are always unaware of what's happening in the news, for good and for bad, have no idea what's going on, super unplugged, carrying on with their lives. Have they won at life, Stuart?
I don't know.
Are they doing something better than me?
is ignorance bliss, right? That's, I guess that's the question. I think there's a point, though, right? There's a point of when you know, gathering information and being informed is important. But then at some point there, because diminishing returns, right? And diminishing returns, and we were talking about this also in the green room, that at what point is it going to change any action that you're going to do, right? So you might have some information. You're like, oh, I'm going to then, you know, tell my family, or I'm going to maybe call my congressman or something like that. But once you sort of do the action based on the information that you acquired, maybe you should unplug.
How do you get out of the doom scrolling spiral?
You may need to set, well, for you, I don't know if you can. I mean, there's some jobs
where you literally cannot.
You know, right? I think that that's important to notice. And like, what types of supports do you have when this has to be your work? But I think moving your phone away physically, which literally elevates people's, you know, heart rate, using an alarm clock so it's not the first thing that you're doing in the morning. I think that it's also replacing it. We say always replace a coping strategy, because this is a coping strategy, this doom scrolling, with reading or connecting. Being aware of things helps us connect. We are primed to connect with other people. This gives us the false understanding that we're actually connecting, and we're not. We're disconnecting.
Yeah, I love for it to be like, there's something inside me that feels rewarded when I can have that conversation starter, or when someone brings up that thing, and if I know what they're talking about, yes. I jump in and I, you know, I can add to it because I read that story and then I read the follow-up story and I know the latest. But yeah.
So there's ROI for you.
Yeah.
You feel like you can be a part of that room and that conversation in a way that feels helpful. It's when it becomes, when you start to sit in powerlessness. And the thing is, when you're constantly surrounding with sadness and with tragedy all the time, that's all you're consuming, that the symptomology of that is depression and anxiety, and it can really lead to further isolation.
But unlike the friends I mentioned earlier, Stuart, there really is an importance in staying informed. Because as I said, that was for the bad, right? You should know what's happening around you, right? Whether it impacts your life or not, you should know what's happening across the globe, shouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think knowing about, you know, what's going on in the world and what affects you and your family is very important. But at some point, though, I think like Alexa is saying, we start to get in this negative spiral we call rumination, right? Of sort of this repeated negative thinking that goes over and over and over again, and repeated worrying also about their future, this sort of repeated negative thinking. And then there's also this process called co-rumination, where we do that with other people. Where just this cycle that we do with our friends, whether it's in person or whether it's online in our social media communications, of back and forth postings and negative, and this co-rumination process that it's wheel spinning.
How does the body respond to the stress and this negative news, as you described?
Yeah, not well.
Tell me what's happening inside.
Yeah, and so we have this cortisol response that's in our brain that increases when we have stress, particularly chronic stress. So there's one thing where, you know, you have like a sudden scare, right? You have a big spike in cortisol, but this sort of prolonged, sort of mild chronic stress does a lot of damage to our systems, our heart, our brain, our memory. Our stomachs are, you know, we know we get the sort of the
like that knot,
the knots in your stomach for sure. And so doing what you can to try to, first be aware of that, of knowing, you know, if you're getting into this vicious cycle is I guess the first step, trying to identify, oh, here's what I'm doing. And I'm doing this maybe co-rumination process with my friends and people online. And then as best you can, trying to unplug, or as the kids say, go touch grass, you know, go outside and just sort of touch grass and that can be really
like
helpful.
We used to do back in the 90s as a child. I'd go outside and play until the streetlights went off. Like, my kids know nothing about that. Right. Tell me this from the mental health standpoint, Alexa. What is happening to our brains when we're just saturated with these headlines?
Well, we are in fight or flight. We are operating in a place where our body feels like we have to survive, when that may not be the truth of what's going on. And so your decision, you know, building on Stuart's point, your decision-making is skewed. Your relationships with people can become fraught because you're distracted. It's hard to pay attention. It's hard to be decisive. And we're sitting in a place of a lot of anger where there's not a lot of movement in that anger. So, yeah, it's dangerous to be all consumed with only negative things. And just as you just mentioned about the grass, we know that our environment can reduce rumination if green, if bright, if positive, if open, if welcoming. And now replace that with what the environment of a lot of people are, which is dark and tragic and violent. I mean, the amount of violence you can now have access to online is also. And so to Stuart's point, it is as though you are experiencing that same event. It is that it becomes that close to us.
And how does social media play a role in that?
Well, and their you know, social media influencers and other news influencers are also often elevating the negative story. That's the clickbait, right? So we're feeding into that cycle as well as consumers.
Mm-hmm. These symptoms that we're discussing, you know, how the body's feeling, what's happening in our minds, does that change if someone has a personal connection to the story? Because right now I feel like we're talking about, you know, when we witness things happening across the world or, you know, to our neighbor. What about when it's actually happening to our families, to us?
We're losing empathy. We have so much access to so many people's challenges that we don't actually feel them as deeply, or because if we did, we wouldn't be able to survive. I'm curious your perspective.
Yeah, I think when you have a personal connection to it, I think it just becomes more salient, right? So if it's like, and sometimes, you know, the bad stories that are happening in other cities and in other countries, like, oh, well, that's them. And we're, you know, especially in Chicago, for example, we feel often we're in a little bubble.
Oh, that's happening in Boston. We're in Chicago.
Right, right, right. And so I think Alexa's right that it's sometimes there's a lack of empathy. But when it does hit home, it's just like, oh, my gosh, like this is, it almost makes it a little more real.
Yeah. Why is it like that? Why is that the default, you think?
I think because we are, at our core, community-based people.
For sure.
And we have pride, and we think if it's that close to us, it could happen to us too. So there's also a level of threat.
Mm-hmm. So give us then some tips and tricks for managing stress in general. Let's start there. Stuart?
Yeah, I think first sort of identifying when you are feeling stressed, sort of being aware in yourself. So noticing when your hands are clenched or your shoulders are tight and you have the knot in your stomach.
That's my number one symptom. It's the tight shoulders. Mm. I'll raise my shoulders. I just did it actually, but you couldn't hear it over the mic, thank goodness. I raised my shoulders and one of them popped.
Wow. Yeah.
Maybe I'm just also out of shape, but I digress.
Yeah, but identifying that and then being
it's
okay, and then relaxing. And when your shoulders go down, that's sort of the first step.
Right.
And when your body's relaxed, then your mind can be relaxed. And the opposite is also, if your body's tense, your mind is tense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step. And then as best you can, as we were saying before, trying to unplug and trying to you know, go outside and be with people socially, to enjoy the beautiful summer, and do what you can and it's not like the news is going to go away.
Yeah. But don't unplug too much.
For sure.
Especially
this show.
Noon.
Well, and find gratitude. You know, how often are we seeing people when we are connecting? You know, anxiety is contagious. And so we're like, and this, and this, and this. Like, how do we kind of try to also change the tone in the conversation so that when we are connecting, it feels rejuvenating and not depleting?
Mm-hmm. Are there resources that you want to point folks to dealing with headline anxiety?
Well, people are always welcome to call the NAMI helpline. Always. If you just want to talk about the stress of the day, we have seen increases in calls to both 988 and to our helpline based on the news and people feeling marginalized. So we are here for you. We see you. It's free. It's confidential. I also think just like naming who in your life feels like a safe person to connect with around these issues. And then also remembering that you are not powerless. You know, to Stuart's point, like what would make you feel activated in these moments politically? Is it contacting your congressperson? Is it figuring out what advocacy efforts are possible? Remembering that, you know, you too are a healer in your community too, if you can show up maybe in a different way.
Yeah. So that call to action. That sense to, you know, get up and do something, that can help with our mental.
Absolutely, yeah, especially doing things for other people. You know, whether it's volunteer work or other charitable activities, makes us feel good inherently.
Yeah. Any other specific tips and tricks that you want to leave folks with, Stuart, just in the case of news fatigue?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think, like we were saying before, like being on the doom scrolling is an attempt to sort of try to get control of a situation. But there's other things you can do to try to get control. So doing things to take care of your body, to eat well, to sleep well, those basic activities.
Yeah. we'll leave it there for now. That's Alexa James, who's CEO of NAMI Chicago, and Stuart Shankman, who's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern Medicine. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
I'm going to try to take that advice.
And we're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.